They're talking about jobs at the White House today, something Americans have been talking about at home for months and months.
I've been underemployed or unemployed for close to 2 years. There is no option for me.
We'll get new unemployment numbers tomorrow, but right now, at least one out of every 10 Americans is looking for work, officially. The number's actually higher than that. And for the unemployed, there is no higher priority than finding work.
I had graduated a year ago and couldn't find a job, still can't find a job.
As the president prepares for his job summit on Pennsylvania Avenue, we convene our own here.
My husband worked in the auto industry and has since lost his job.
On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
And this is Thursday, December 3rd, 2009, where our takeaway is considering whether a job summit at the White House actually puts people back to work.
And do people actually expect that the government is going to be able to do something about the on-the-ground unemployment rate? Do they think the government is going to be able to help find the job? That's a
good
question.
Government better hire them, maybe.
Maybe. Good morning. We're going to update you on the roadblocks between Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke and his renomination in the Senate. Also, military families explain how they prepare for quick deployment to Afghanistan. In today's headlines, President Obama puts the focus on jobs today. As we mentioned, he's invited 130 executives, union heads, and business leaders to the White House to get feedback on how to turn the unemployment tide. Right now, though, we have someone who's going to attend President Obama's job summit later today. Ken Rogers joins us. He's the executive director of Automation Alley in Troy, Michigan. Ken, what are you planning to tell the president today?
I'm going to tell the president that we need jobs now. And in order to do that, we need access to capital. That they need to support small business accelerators that are creating new companies and new jobs, and that we need to cut taxes on small business.
Okay, so I don't know how many unemployed people they're going to be there rather than executives and legislators, but if there were people there that were looking for jobs, maybe an unemployed auto worker from Michigan, what would you tell them? Is there something they could be doing to find work?
First of all, I tell them that we went through this in the 80s, and we had a recovery in Michigan. It was significant, and we'll have another recovery. But unfortunately, we've got more pain, I guess, immediately in front of us. But go back to school, don't lose hope, diversify your skills, and know that change is coming in Michigan.
A little hope from Ken Rogers, the executive director of Automation Alley. We're going to talk more about that job summit in just a few minutes.
As the president shifts his focus to jobs, his defense secretary, Robert Gates, was on Capitol Hill yesterday to defend that new strategy in Afghanistan and to say the 2011 pullout date is not set in stone.
We will have a thorough review in December 2010. If it appears that the strategy is not working, and that we are not going to be able to transition in 2011, then we will take a hard look at the strategy itself.
People are taking a hard look at the Pakistani Prime Minister Yusuf Raza Gilani's statement this morning in London that he says he does not think Osama bin Laden is hiding in his country. Earlier on The Takeaway, we asked Adil Najam, professor of international relations at Boston University and a Pakistani American, about that claim.
He's probably telling the truth if he's saying he doesn't know where Osama bin Laden is. I don't think he does. I don't think anyone else does.
Well, back to the U.S. economy. Bank of America knows where $45 billion it received from the Treasury is. It's back in the Treasury. The nation's largest lender needed the money during the financial meltdown, and it's going to be the first bank to completely pay off the Treasury.
Speaking of banks, Congress took a big step yesterday. A House committee cleared the way for a sweeping financial regulation bill to be voted on next week. The bill gives regulators the power to break up financial firms before they threaten the economy. And the Federal Reserve says the economy gained traction in the last 2 months, with eight of the Fed's regions showing an improvement. Chairman Ben Bernanke has confirmation hearings later today for another 4 years as head of the nation's central bank. We're going to talk about that.
GE made its official. It's unloading NBC Universal to Comcast for almost $14 billion in cash. Asian markets rallied for the fourth straight day. Gold hit another record high. The S&P opens at 1,109.
Coming up later this hour, we're going to talk about weather balloons that don't have boys in them, why the Defense Department is asking you to keep your eyes on the sky. And we're asking you, what will you not do in order to get a job, or do you have advice for others? 8778-MY-TAKE.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Jobless recovery is a phrase that a lot of us have heard probably too much over the past year or so, but it's a reality, and that's why last month President Barack Obama announced his job summit.
We have an obligation to consider every additional responsible step that we can to encourage and accelerate job creation in this country. And that's why in December, we'll be holding a forum at the White House on jobs and economic growth. We'll gather CEOs and small business owners, economists and financial experts, as well as representatives from labor unions and nonprofit groups to talk about how we can work together to create jobs and get this economy moving again.
The day is today. The president will be hosting his job summit later on. And in response, Newt Gingrich has announced yesterday, he announced that he's going to launch his own real job summit. We'll get more details on that as they come out. But setting the politics of these summits aside, unemployment is above 10%. The real number, the real unemployment number, is somewhere around 16 or 17%. Americans need work. Many people who started months ago saying they would not relocate, they couldn't accept less than $50,000 a year, wouldn't go into sales, they're now saying, I don't care what it is or where it is, just get me a job. So the Takeaway is hosting its own job summit today. First, we have Dan Gross with us. He's a senior editor of Newsweek and a very widely read financial and economics writer. And Dan, I'm looking for good news from you. We are expecting out the unemployment numbers tomorrow. Do we have any idea what they're going to look like?
Well, I think the rate will probably be over 10%. I think it's likely that payroll job growth will be negative again. But I think, you know, I did a column about a month ago saying that the next surprise we may have in this economy may be that we'll be generating jobs sooner rather than later. And I say that not because I, you know, see help wanted signs, but just because of the kind of macroeconomic data. The economy is growing at about a 3.5% rate. Productivity has been growing at an 8 or 9% rate, which means that basically employers are asking employees to kind of run ever faster on the treadmill. And at a certain point, they have to break down and hire new people. And I think that moment may be coming, you know, in the next couple months. One just little data point that came out, we had car sales figures. GM said that in the first quarter of 2010, its car production will be up 75% from the first quarter of 2009, and that Ford's will be about 50% higher than the first quarter of 2009. And even if you're heavily mechanized and have all the robots in the world, you can't boost production like that without hiring new people. What we saw in the first part of 2009 was this just really aggressive cutting back, basically shutting down factories, firing everybody in sight, preparing for Armageddon. We're no longer in Armageddon, and people are going to have to start recalling workers to keep up with some of this demand that is, you know, it's coming in, but not at a massive rate. So
okay,
I'm somewhat optimistic that we will have job growth sooner rather than later.
That's good news probably for Ken Rogers. He's the executive director of Automation Alley. That's Automation Alley is a nonprofit technology business association in Troy, Michigan. We also have Dave Thompson with us. He's the news director of Prairie Public Radio in North Dakota. And you may be asking yourself, why do we have someone on the air from North Dakota? Well,
it's
Dave,
a boom town up
Thompson.
There. Yeah.
Yeah. North Dakota, your state has consistently had one of the lowest unemployment rates in the country. You guys have a secret, and you've been hiding it from us, right?
We have several secrets that we've been hiding from you.
Well, what are they? You're going to spill the beans.
Well, why
how
North
has
Dakota
North Dakota kept
so well
its unemployment?
Is because we are commodity driven. We're driven by oil and wind power, which has really exploded in North Dakota. And also, we're driven by agriculture and agriculture-related businesses. So businesses that produce ag products or also produce equipment that help produce ag products do very well here. It's been a little bit stagnant because ag prices have been a little flat this year. However, there are still smiles on farmers' faces and smiles on the manufacturers' faces.
Okay, so, Ken, are there things that people can learn from a state like North Dakota, or is it too localized, the question of jobs? Because we're asking ourselves, to what extent can the government actually get jobs for people? And you heard Dave Thompson out of North Dakota. Is that something that a state individually can do, or can the government do it?
Well, I don't think, you know, government is the answer for all our needs and all our problems. They need to facilitate business, cut taxes for business. They need to provide business an opportunity to succeed. And as Dan was saying, you know, the auto industry went through a huge shakeup in Michigan. We lost thousands and thousands of jobs, but they're poised, the auto industry is poised to come back. And there will be hiring that's coming up. And in Michigan, we're looking towards the future. We've sure been rocked with unemployment and an auto industry in transition. But I want to tell North Dakota we're coming back.
All right, well, let's talk about that poised bit. Ken Rogers, Executive Director of Automation Alley in Troy, Michigan, and Dan Gross, columnist for Newsweek, because he was referring to really that productivity precipice, right? Isn't it contingent on the government? And Ken, you can respond to this, or Dan. Isn't it contingent on the government, on Barack Obama, to say, hey, folks, you know, let's forget the productivity. Let's start hiring people at this point. Because productivity really only affects the stock price. It doesn't really affect the U.S. economy. Ken?
Well, I just think that the bottom line is that there are some things that the government could be doing right now, as an example, using the SBA loan programs. To change lending limits for small business, raising manufacturing company limits so that they have more access to capital, and microloans rising from $35,000 to $50,000 helps create an atmosphere for business to succeed. And so I think the issue is always productivity from our perspective.
Dan, let's go to you last for the wrap-up on this. We get calls from listeners all the time who are unemployed or underemployed. Some of them have part-time work and are looking for full-time work. And they give us all kinds of reasons why they haven't been able to get a job. Some of them say, it's because of my age. We had a caller from Michigan say, I was told that people don't hire someone who's unemployed already. And what can you say to these people who are unemployed? Are they looking to these reasons that aren't really the reason? Has it just been the economy? Or are there actually things that people can do to their resume, to their approach?
Well, of course there are things that can do, but I think looking and saying that people who don't have jobs don't have them because, you know, their skills aren't in place or because they don't want them is kind of blaming the victim. I think what's still underappreciated, we had an economy that was sprinting in 06 and 07 and then basically suffered a near-death experience. And we are back up and perhaps walking, but not even jogging. This collapse in demand, in business investment, was like nothing we've seen in our lifetime. And employers are, as a result, kind of hesitant to believe that the recovery is real, that all the stuff that's going on is working. And that makes them very reluctant to hire. In other words, yeah, the economy is growing again. We're seeing the stock market improving, obviously. Maybe their orders are picking up or they're kind of inching back up from their lows, but they don't believe it's real. They think that something could go wrong in the next few months, whether it's a Dubai situation or another credit problem. And so they're really reluctant to hire. And until employers and companies start to believe that what they've seen in the past few months is going to continue, and then they have two and three quarters behind
right.
them of, oh, it's not as bad as we thought it was, that's when they will start hiring. So I really think it's a macro question of confidence and people not believing the recovery is real and needing more evidence of it before they start hiring.
That's Dan Gross, a columnist for Newsweek. We also spoke to Ken Rogers, the executive director of Automation Alley in Troy, Michigan, and Dave Thompson. He's the news director of Prairie Public Radio in North Dakota. Thanks to all of you for being with us. It is 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in on headlines.
So Osama bin Laden is not in Pakistan, according to Yousif Jilani, the prime minister of Pakistan, who's been speaking in London. Back in the U.S., votes are scheduled in the Senate today on two issues that have dominated early debate on health care legislation. Ben Bernanke goes in front of the Senate Banking Committee today. He's hoping to be confirmed, but he may have some obstacles. We'll talk about that coming up this hour.
And tonight, the President and First Lady will attend the National Christmas Tree Lighting Ceremony. This year, the public tickets are being distributed via a lottery system. Coming up, our eyes have been on health care in Afghanistan, but there are other things going on in Congress. We're going to check with Todd Zwillick, our D.C. correspondent.
Want that to go.
And at the news takeout counter this morning, we got Louise Story of our partner in the New York Times and Todd Zwillick, our D.C. correspondent. They're going to share some insights into some economic stories that are emerging from Washington in a moment. But our look at some news stories we're staying on top of begins with a number of takeouts from you on the Obama administration strategy in Afghanistan. Military families wanted more information.
My name is Rodell Durbin. I'm a truck driver, but I'm also recently retired from the National Guard. Now, this 30,000 troop enhancement over in Afghanistan, which I've been there from 2004 to 2005. How many are they going to end up pulling back into service from the retired reserves and the inactive ready reserves from the Guards and reserve units?
That's a great question.
That's a very good question. Yeah. We learned from you that maybe the message from President Obama was clearer to the rest of the world than it was to us.
My name is Asim Khan, and I'm calling from East Meadow in Long Island. I think Mr. Obama sent a clear message to all the parties involved in Afghanistan, including Afghani people, the Pakistan people, and the U.S. military also.
And the DJ thinks the whole NATO-Afghanistan strategy is flawed. She emails us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. You don't fight terrorism with a land invasion. You fight it with carefully targeted attacks. This is the Israeli method. With our methods, we're at a disadvantage. We're sitting ducks for the enemy while we don't know where they are.
And I just knew this would happen. People responded to our discussion yesterday of the popularity and persistence of music on vinyl records. Kat writes to our site, the site thetakeaway.org, when my husband and I started collecting vinyl as college students 7 years ago, you could get 5 records for a dollar at the Salvation Army. Now they're $3 each. If that's not an economic indicator for the market, I don't know what is. Long live vinyl. That's great.
But, John, you know my skepticism on the whole target. Shared by one of our listeners. We learned that behind all that vinyl is another box of wretched retro.
Hey, this is Billy from Oklahoma. You know, we just got to kill the vinyl, because if we don't, I'm afraid we're never going to get rid of my dad's 8-track tapes.
What about his Pac-Man game? Does your dad have a Pac-Man game or 8 tracks in a box somewhere? Let us know by keeping the conversation going about anything we've been talking about. 877-8-MY-TAKE, or shoot us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Well, Louise Story, we're not going to ask you about whether you own vinyl or not, but I am going to ask you about Ben Bernanke, not about whether he owns vinyl, but his Senate nomination. He's up for reconfirmation for a second term as Federal Reserve Chairman, and there's some unexpected pushback. What's going on in the Senate?
So we've got the senator from Vermont, Bernard Sanders, who's one of the more left-leaning members of Congress, who said yesterday he's not going to vote for Bernanke. And he had some pretty harsh words. He said to one of my colleagues, in this country, there is a profound disgust at what happened on Wall Street. And he thinks the Fed has watched out for the banks and Wall Street more than it's watched out for average Americans. And this is something we're hearing a lot of senators, you know, Chris Dodd from Connecticut and Richard Shelby from Alabama, they're on the banking committee. They have sharply criticized the Fed. They have not said they're not going to vote for Bernanke, but they've criticized the Fed.
Okay, so to what extent is this them complaining and making a stand, but in the end, Bernanke gets reconfirmed anyway?
He has a lot of support. Remember, he wasn't there when the problem was created, and he only needs 60 votes to get this up for vote and to get it passed. So
only 60.
Yeah, only
60. But he has strong support. So what's happened with Sanders from Vermont for his remarks is that now, instead of a simple majority, Bernanke will be needing 60 votes.
Which is an uphill battle. I mean, you know, Bernanke has a constituency on Wall Street, which you report on all the time.
Right.
You've spent a lot of time down in Washington focusing on the bank regulation and the Bernanke story. Todd Zwillick, our Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd, you know, do you agree with Louise's assessment that this is suddenly an uphill battle for Bernanke with this 60-vote trigger?
Well, it's a lot more of an uphill battle than he should have had, being a Fed chairman nominated for a second term. Bernie Sanders did a lot more than say he's not going to vote for Bernanke. He's putting a hold on his nomination. And what that means is that it's not going anywhere until Sanders gives it the go-ahead. Now, Harry Reid can circumvent it with 60 votes. That's absolutely true. But that he can also delay things a lot. And I talked to his guy last night, one of his staffers. They're going to want a lot more discussion from Bernanke and in general about transparency at the Fed, about their management of credit and management of the housing crisis and AIG. So this Sanders can make this go a little slower than I think the administration would have wanted.
All right, but this is showboating more than actual shutdown. Both of you, Louise.
Another interesting thing that Sanders is pushing for, along with Ron Paul in the House, got it passed in the House, is an audit of the Fed, which would be an unprecedented look at how they operate, what they're doing. The Fed and Bernanke are arguing this should not happen. They're saying it would undermine their independence to have Congress crawling through there investigating. But that's another thing that Sanders of Vermont wants, and perhaps that will be a bargaining chip he'll play in this fight where he's kind of holding up Bernanke's confirmation.
I guess I'm wondering, Todd and Louise, I mean, does Barack Obama simply wave a magic wand and say, leave Bernanke alone and it's all over with?
I'm not sure Obama has a magic wand.
I'm not sure he does either. Less of one on Capitol Hill than he used to, and with all of the heavy lifts on the Afghan war, certainly health care that are going on. Members, especially progressives like Sanders, they want to show their muscle here. They don't want to be wanded anymore.
Before we go, Todd, the gate crashers down in Washington, you haven't mentioned much about this. You were actually off Thanksgiving week. So what's going on? Do you have anything to add to that story?
I know how much you guys are dying to see the gate crashers, and maybe you would have gotten a shot at it today. The House Homeland Security Committee is holding a hearing into the gate crashers incident. Alas, the Salahi's lawyer walked through the room last night, and the word from the committee is they might not be appearing today on camera, which is a shame.
What's MSNBC going to do?
They said they may not. There's a chance they could show up, so take heart. They might be on TV today.
All right, so who has more likely? Will Ben Bernanke get confirmed, or will the Salahis show up on Capitol Hill? Give us a prediction, Louise.
I think Bernanke has a lot of support. I'll go with him.
Todd?
And a few more credentials, too.
Todd?
I think Bernanke has a lot of support, but you're foolish if you stand between the Salahis and a camera.
You're
so
right.
I'm going to call it a wash.
That's a medical issue.
There's your takeaway.
Todd Zwillick and Louise Story from our part of the New York Times. Coming up, we're checking with military families. They have their own news agenda when they hear President Obama's Afghanistan speech this week.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, you can do the math. 30,000 new U.S. forces go to Afghanistan. There are many more people affected if you count the military families. And what are the to-do lists like as those families get ready to ship out? We're going to talk to some service members in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. Yesterday, Afghanistan. Today, jobs at the White House. President Obama has invited 130 business leaders to the White House to get feedback on how to tackle unemployment. North Dakota is one state consistently showing low unemployment rates. We, earlier this morning, spoke to Dave Thompson from Prairie Public Radio in North Dakota.
We are commodity-driven. We're driven by oil and wind power, and also we're driven by agriculture and agriculture-related businesses.
North Dakota's good luck may not translate into a national story, but the president wants to sound out ideas wherever he can find them, like targeted tax credits and increased access to financing for small businesses. Bank of America will be the first bank to completely pay off its bailout. $45 billion from Bank of America is on its way back to the Treasury. GE bowing out of show business. It's selling its 51% stake in NBC, as expected, to Comcast today. The cost, almost $14 billion in cash and assets.
And those two stories were driving stock futures up this morning on Wall Street. Asian and European markets saw boosts as well. Wall Street is waiting on the weekly jobless claims to be released in the next few minutes. Analysts expect a jump in new claims. More now on a story we told you about last week. Environmental officials in Illinois dumped toxic chemicals into a shipping canal near Chicago last night in an all-out assault to stop the Asian carp from reaching Lake Michigan. The fish can grow up to 4 feet long and weigh 100 pounds. This is the latest and some say the last effort to keep the fish out of the Great Lakes. And we're learning new details about the troop surge in Afghanistan. Our partner, the New York Times, says the majority of the new combat forces are heading to the Helmand and Kandahar regions. It's an area the size of West Virginia, and it's also the spiritual and financial base of the Taliban. Those are some of the stories that we're watching this morning.
So, this morning, are you headed for Kandahar? Some of the military families who are in that 30,000 troop surge announced by President Obama this week know who they are at this point. 40 million Americans watched President Obama's speech on Tuesday, and certainly no families watched it more closely than military families. And joining us now are Mary Galletti. Her husband, Russell Galletti, is a first lieutenant with the Ohio National Guard. He's deployed in Hungary, training with NATO forces, and he's going to be deployed to Afghanistan in January. Mary, good morning.
Good morning.
And Colonel Bill Buckner is public affairs officer for the 18th Airborne Corps at Fort Bragg in North Carolina. He's been to Iraq twice. Colonel, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, John. Thank you.
So, Mary Galletti, what's a to-do list like for a family who hears, first of all, a speech by the president, and then families are going to be receiving orders? Some may already have received orders. How do you start to put a to-do list together to get everything done before you ship out?
Well, if you're a reserve family, like we are, a National Guard family, you have to think a little differently. Oftentimes, your service member is leaving their regular job and moving on to full-time military, which means health insurance has to change. There's a lot of paperwork to fill out. There's just all kinds of transitions professionally that can be pretty stressful in a family in terms of financial type issues. And quite honestly, there becomes this parade that you have to do. You have to see everybody and spend quality time with them, but often time is pretty short. So that tends to be the biggest challenge emotionally.
And this is all happening right around the holidays. If your husband ships out in January, your holidays are going to be consumed with these kinds of logistics, right?
Yeah, it's going to be a pretty crazy Christmas this year.
How are you going to handle it? Just to give me a sense of how you're going to deal with the logistics.
We're starting to basically make a list of everyone we need to cross paths with. We're calling it our nice list, and trying to figure out how we're going to see everybody, and trying to balance expectations, and hopefully we'll get some time to ourselves, too.
Well, Mary Galletti's husband, Russell, is a first lieutenant with the Ohio National Guard. He'll be deployed to Afghanistan in January. She's on the line from Cleveland. Colonel Bill Buckner, who's joining us from Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Colonel, what are the conversations with the family, kids particularly? I mean, kids, as we know, are total news hounds when they know their parents might be shipped out. So they probably listen to the speech and immediately have questions for mom and dad, and particularly if they're officers. How does that work?
I think it's pretty much like what Marriott said earlier in terms of just trying to spend some quality time with your family. I have two kids myself. They've experienced their deployments, and so really it's just about communicating to them, you know what you're going to do, sort of what the timeline is, and trying to put them at a certain sense of ease. For me personally, I was gone during my daughter's senior year for the most part, and in the first part of her freshman year in college. And so you really miss out on that. And so how do you figure out how do you continue to stay in contact with one another and to communicate? So whether it's through email, webcams, whatever you're doing, you try to put those things in place that you can continue to have those sort of relationships and conversations.
Do you have a metaphor that you use with your kids to explain what it is that you're doing and approaching the sort of issues of danger that are clearly there in the background?
No, not really. I mean, I've been in the Army for 28 years, so they are accustomed to it. The units that I've been assigned to, in fact, I was at Fort Drum, New York, in the 1st Brigade there at Watertown. And so they're used to all the training, all the things we do. And I think we have a pretty good, system in place to make sure people and the families understand, as much as they can about what we're doing. And so we try to do that through our family readiness groups and through just constant interaction with the families.
Mary, I had a friend who is in the Army for a very, very long time, all the way up until about 8 years ago, and he went through his entire Army career and never once got deployed to a place of war and combat. But the soldiers that are serving now are very likely, if not guaranteed, to end up in combat. And I'm wondering, how does it affect your family when you're planning for a deployment, say, to Korea, where they're likely going to be doing routine duties every day, as opposed to a place like the Colonel was just talking about, where you're going to be in danger of being wounded or perhaps killed?
I would feel like the primary strain on the relationship is not necessarily the imminent danger. It's the different schedule and the different lifestyle. I mean, the imminent danger is really hard, don't get me wrong, and certainly really stressful, but being on the other side of the world, having a totally different schedule, expectations being different, being out of the family rhythm, I think is what's really, really stressful on the family, more so than the imminent danger. I think the imminent danger just sort of adds a wish to want to stay away from cable news networks because you just can't handle seeing what might be without having more information.
Spend more time on TMZ than CNN, I guess.
Back to the Salahis, right?
Yeah, Mary brings up a very good point, too. It's not so much about the danger aspect of it. Is more or less, it's really a lot of the things that have to take place. For example, in my case, and many of the soldiers' cases, we have college-bound or college-age children, where you're going through the FAFSA process, you're going through all of the application process. Well, your spouse ends up having to go through that by herself. And so you try to stay connected to that as much as you can. and try to do things in advance to move that along. But those are simple things that take place that suddenly become very complex because you're removed by several thousand miles, the time differences, how do you communicate all of this. And so just something as simple as preparing your child to go to college becomes a little bit more complex than it normally would.
Colonel Buckner, thanks so much for joining us. Colonel Bill Buckner is Public Affairs Officer for the 18th Airborne Corps at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. He's been to Iraq twice. Mary Galletti, her husband Russell Galletti, First Lieutenant with the Ohio National Guard, is deployed in Hungary right now, training with NATO forces, and will be deployed to Afghanistan in January. There's a sense of what families go through as they begin to ship out, the implications, human implications of the orders that President Obama is issuing now. Coming up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane, no, it's a big red Defense Department contest to spot weather balloons. It's all about sociology. More later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. California and water, a love-hate relationship that stretches back for decades.
The bond issue passes Tuesday. There'll be $8 million to build an aqueduct and reservoir. I'm doing it.
Going to be a lot of irate citizens when they find out that they're paying for water that they're not going to get.
Oh, that's all taken care of. See, Mr. Gitz, either you bring the water to L.A. or you bring L.A. to the water.
The days of scandal and corruption over water in California that took place in Roman Polanski's classic Chinatown may be in the past or maybe not. It looks like the task of bringing water to L.A. is going to be immeasurably harder in the future. Experts released their lowest estimates ever for how much water they'll be able to deliver next year, only 5% of what's been requested by cities and farms. Eric Garner joins us now. He's the managing partner of Best and Krieger and is one of the leading experts on water in California. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning, Celeste.
We are used to hearing dire reports about the water situation in California. What makes this one more dire than the others we've heard before?
I think there are a couple of factors. The first is we've had 3 years of dry weather, and so that's lowered the storage levels in our water reservoirs. And another part of it is the environmental protections that have been put in place in the last couple of years. In California, most of the water's in the north and most of the people's in the south. Moving it causes some significant environmental impacts, and so the restrictions limit how much water can be moved.
When they talk about being able to deliver only 5% of what's been requested by cities and farms, that sounds incredible to me. Is it normal that they are only able to deliver a fraction of the water that's asked for?
Well, normally the fraction isn't as low as 5%, but certainly probably the chronic issue and the real issue California faces right now is not one 5% year, but it's that on a long-term basis, the State Water Project and the Central Valley Project, which are the projects that deliver most of the water in California, may only be able to deliver something in the order of 25 to 30% of what they were anticipated to deliver.
The governor, Schwarzenegger, he's called for people to begin conserving water. He's been calling for that for well over a year. Is this finally the time when people have to do it? Is Southern California going to have to acknowledge that it's a desert?
Well, I think Southern California has been acknowledging it's a desert for at least the last 20 years. It may have taken a while, but I think Southern California has been. And the new legislation requires additional conservation. Certainly per capita use in Southern California has dropped significantly in the last couple decades. But there's no question there's going to have to be additional conservation in both the urban and agricultural sectors going forward. But there's also going to have to be just more efficient use of water or reallocation of water in the
Eric
state.
Garner, I got to just quibble you for one moment. Maybe they've acknowledged it on some level, but they've also been purchasing millions of gallons of water to keep up their habits in California. Is that going to change?
Yes, actually, I think it is changing, and I think it will continue to change. Because for us to live here, it's going to have to continue to change somewhat.
Well, we'll see whether or not the cities and farms are able to survive on 5% of the water they thought they needed. That's Eric Garner, managing partner of Best and Krieger, a California water expert. He joined us from Riverside, California.
You can bring L.A. to the water, Celeste.
I grew up in Southern California. They've been asking people to conserve for a long time. I mean, Eric's not with us anymore, but I don't buy the fact that they've accepted they live in a desert. I really don't buy it. Everyone has a lawn in California. Well, they water it every day in the summer.
Well, but L.A. was created by the water projects that Chinatown was really
That's
based
exactly
on.
Right.
The question is, have they reached a limit? That's the thing.
I think they've reached a limit. The question is, are they going to accept that limit?
Find the girl.
I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. John, you know I like quizzes, so here's another one.
Okay.
What do red balloons, Facebook, and $40,000 have in common?
Well, you got me.
The Department of Defense. We're going to talk about that more in just a few minutes. Just out about 15 minutes ago, new jobless benefit claims fall unexpectedly for the fifth straight week to 457,000. We're talking to you about jobs all day today. The president is hosting his job summit, and we want to check in with you. How much would you change for a new job? Would you move across the country? And what's the employment picture like in your area? You can be our reporter, too.
My name is Marie. I live in Michigan. I was called for federal jury duty this week. They were sitting a panel of 8 jurors. They probably went through 16 people to get that panel, and 4 of them were unemployed, or their spouse had been. There's a woman who lost her job in October. There's a man who'd been laid off for 2 years. He was a plumber. There was an electrician, and there was a woman whose husband was an automotive designer.
Tell us your story. What it is and isn't. What is a deal breaker for you when it comes to taking a new job? Yeah. You reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes past the hour. The Pakistani Prime Minister Yousif Jilani has been meeting today with his British counterpart, Gordon Brown. In a press conference this morning, Mr. Jilani made a comment that surprised many about the whereabouts of Osama bin Laden.
We have a good intelligence and defense cooperation with the United States. And if there is any credible or actionable information that can be shared with Pakistan, I doubt the information which you are giving is correct, because I don't think that Osama bin Laden is in Pakistan.
Pakistan is central to President Obama's new strategy in Afghanistan.
So let's get a reaction to the new jobless benefit claims, which fell unexpectedly for the fifth straight week to 457,000. Peter Morisi joins us. He's an economist at the University of Maryland. Peter, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, we've been bouncing around the bottom here on these weekly jobless claims. If you were at the job summit this morning, what would your takeaway be to the people who are trying to figure out the employment picture?
Well, the jobless claims are trending down. We will likely stop bleeding jobs by the first quarter of next year. The problem is we will not be adding jobs as rapidly as the labor force grows, and the unemployment rate will peak somewhat higher than 10.5%, perhaps 11.
And, you know, if you're one of the 130 executives, union heads, and business leaders, you know, take it directly from Peter Morisi there. So maybe we'll talk to you tomorrow when the monthly number comes out. Peter, thanks so much.
Take care.
Peter Morisi is a business and economics professor at the University of Maryland.
It's Thursday, and a very interesting technology story today. The U.S. Department of Defense, through the agency called DARPA, that's the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, is launching a bizarre experiment in social networking. Okay, they're sending up 10 huge red weather balloons all across the country. We don't know where they are, but they're asking you out there to go find them. And they're hoping it tells us something about Twitter and Facebook and how they help us communicate. Whoever finds all 10 balloons first wins $40,000. So we have Baratunde Thurston here with us. He's the Takeaway tech contributor and host of Popular Science's Future Of. It's a TV show on the Science Channel. He's joining us today to explain to us, but also to give us some answers, Peter Lee. He's the director of Transformational Convergence Technology, the office at DARPA in Washington. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Baratunde, first, tell us, what is DARPA? What is the point of DARPA? What does DARPA do?
The agency exists, reports directly to the heads of the Defense Department, and finances largely challenge contests, encouraging innovation, not at the request of the military, but things the military might be able to use. So there's been the DARPA Urban Challenge, which was a car that could navigate on its own through an urban landscape. There was the DARPA Grand Challenge, which is to get from point to point on a rugged sort of rural course. And DARPA has been responsible for everything from computer networking, things like the internet, to
gaming.
GPS.
Gaming. I mean, they made hugely great bets on technology, developing in gaming and simulations.
The idea is to spur a kind of raw core research that could help, not directly at the request of a military
agency. Okay, so Peter Lee, you hear us talking about what your job is. Explain this project of sending people out to find these giant red weather balloons. How does this, sending people out to find 10 weather balloons using Facebook and Twitter, how does that help us surprise our enemies or help the Department of Defense?
Well, it's a pretty simple idea. We'll have these 10 balloons in undisclosed public locations on Saturday. And the first person or team that reports the locations of those 10 balloons in commemoration of the 40th anniversary of the Internet will win $40,000. Now, a lot is known in research about how people form teams and collaborate and share information and how that information spreads. But relatively less is known about what happens when people have to compete with each other and have a financial incentive even to withhold information. We're interested in how people establish trust relationships in those situations. We also wanted something that could connect and would be open to everyone, from school children to tech professionals and everyone in between.
And you're kind of hoping that you're going to figure out how these social networking sites actually occur, function under pressure, right?
That's right. There is a time pressure because it's a kind of a race. You know, we, of course, won't learn everything in just one experiment like this. This is a program that could go well into the future. Already by interacting with social networking researchers at universities and companies around the country who will be watching with great interest what goes on, we think a lot of great data and observations will be uncovered.
Baratunde, this is a subject about which I bet you have a lot of interest and curiosity. What do you think about this? Do you think this is a good way to test out the limits of our social networking sites?
Well, I think it's, it certainly seems like a break from the challenges of the past, which were very tactile and tangible. Let's create a machine that does X. There's a finite fixed team, usually at a university or corporation with significant money behind it. And here they're really tapping into the distributed nature, sort of celebrating the Internet's history and going into what I heard described at the PDF conference as an adhocracy. Can you get teams of people quickly together? So that does fascinate me. I think in a time when, the economy is doing what it's doing, it is interesting to ask, like, really, red balloons? Like, how do you know, justifying that from a...
The expense. Why would they spend
And I don't know how expensive it is, but it certainly looks, you know, fun and also a little strange given...
But Peter Lee, I mean, in a sense, you're solving the problems posed to the Iranian government when their election, you know, kind of went awry. All of a sudden, the adhocracy went into action and there was no way of even monitoring
people
it.
You may get
some data that's relevant to what they're interested in doing, controlling the information flow.
Absolutely right. And in fact, you know, it's really a question of what are the benefits and, you know, what is the phenomenon when everything and everybody is connected and can really communicate instantly. How do you create those messages? How do you create significant team building? And where are those nodes of the best information sources, and how do you trust what you hear? All of those are really key questions.
Okay, so Baratunde, I got to ask you. Yeah. I mean, I'm going to ask you to spawn some conspiracy theories here. This all sounds very, very fun and interesting and a great use of social media, but should we be worried about what the Department of Defense is studying in terms of what people will do for money and in terms of how we use our Facebook accounts?
Well, I think this, you know, the way John raised it, it cuts both ways. This is not so much technological as it is sociological and even psychological. And so we can use it to maybe suss out patterns of cells of people coordinating to help defend us. It can also be used, that same information, against us and us being widely defined. So I think we should keep an eye on it. Red balloons are fun. I could use $40,000.
I think Pete has a great job, I think.
He does. Baratunde Thurston is a Takeaway tech contributor, host of Popular Science's Future Of on the Science Channel. Peter Lee, thanks so much. The Director of Transformational Convergence Technology Office at the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency with a very long title. Thanks to Peter Lee. If you want to learn more about that project, go to our website, thetakeaway.org.
And for some of you, finding a red balloon from the Pentagon might be easier than finding a job. We're talking about the president's job summit that he's hosting at the White House. How much would you change for a new job? What would you do to retool? Would you move across the country, learn new skills? What wouldn't you do? John emails us, I have been asked at two separate job interviews if I'd be willing to cheat a customer. I said no to the applicant. I didn't get either job. Tell us your story at 8778-MYTAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Well, we've got one piece of advice from our own job summit.
Go back to school. Don't lose hope. Diversify your skills and know that change is coming in Michigan.
That's your takeaway from Ken Rogers, Executive Director of Automation Alley in Troy, Michigan. I'm John Huckenberry.
And, John, by Friday night, you won't be drinking because the work week's over. You're going to be clinking a little champagne, right? Celebrating
right.
The addition of number five.
Well, if all goes well, we will have Huckenberry number five, kid number five, on
added
Friday
to
evening.
Two sets of twins.
Right. Two sets of twins.
Yeah,
yes.
Number five.
I'm quitting, actually. Going to spend more time with my new baby. No, sorry. I'm John Huckenberry.
I'm Celeste Headley. This is The Takeaway.
A quarter century after the poison came from the sky, Bhopal, India, is still living through the worst industrial accident of our time.
So what we have is a medical disaster, a human disaster, far larger today than 25 years back.
The 8,000 people who died at Bhopal may have been the lucky ones. Hundreds of thousands of people still live the legacy of poison from a factory that's long closed and a company, Union Carbide, that no longer exists.
This is the formulation of a chemical some of us in Union Carbide call liquid dynamite.
The chemical was methyl isocyanate, echoes of a silent explosion from another ground zero, a lament for Bhopal on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Huckenberry and Celeste Headley from Public Radio International and WNYC.
It's Thursday, December 3rd, where the takeaway is, for me, that the history of Bhopal seems to have taught us very little.
Well, it's one of the global takeaways. Half the world, though, has probably never heard of the Bhopal disaster. Mm-hmm. A generation later, heavy industry and large vulnerable human populations are still living closer together than ever. We're going to update you on the details emerging of the troop surge in Afghanistan that was announced this week. And there's the big story of Pakistan's role in the new strategy.
Well, let's get right to it. New jobless numbers out in the past half hour. The number of Americans who filed new unemployment claims fell for the fifth straight week. It's still a big number at 457,000, but that's 9,000 less than last week. President Obama wants to shrink that number even further. He's holding a job summit at the White House today where he'll speak to business leaders about the best way to tackle unemployment. And what a difference 8 months makes. We're not talking about your upcoming baby. We're talking about Bank of America. They're paying back the $45 billion aid package that they got from the Treasury. The nation's largest lender is the first bank to completely pay off the bailout loan. We're going to talk to Louise Story about that at the bottom of the hour.
Another economic story. It's been in the works for a while. Comcast finally pulled the trigger on the NBC Universal deal this morning. It will pay GE nearly $14 billion and have a 51% stake in the company. Moving on to the surge in Afghanistan, ramifications across the board in Pakistan. Speaking in London this morning, the Pakistani Prime Minister, Yusuf Raza Gilani, says he doesn't think Osama bin Laden is hiding in his country. On The Takeaway, we asked Adil Najam, professor of international relations at Boston University, how the prime minister could possibly know that.
This notion that somehow the Prime Minister of Pakistan has the address and the exact place where Osama bin Laden is really quite nonsense.
More in that discussion coming right up.
And here's a story we found this morning. Tobacco giant Reynolds American, the country's number two maker of cigarettes, has agreed to buy the maker of the nicotine gum. No word on what they plan to do with it. Asian markets rallied for the fourth straight day and gold hit another record high. Stocks are set to open fast on the Bank of America news, probably influenced by job numbers as well. The Dow will get going at 10,452, the S&P at 1,109, and the NASDAQ at 2,185.
So 25 years after the Bhopal disaster, we spoke to the BBC's World Affairs correspondent Alan Little, and I asked him, what were the obvious lessons learned from Bhopal a quarter century later?
Well, if you ask the people of Bhopal, they will talk about the lessons to be learned concerning the nature of the responsibility that large corporations, particularly international corporations, have to the people among whom they operate. Two things concern those people more than any. The first is the ongoing, the enduring medical catastrophe of it. Children born many years after the initial gas leak have been born with birth defects and chronic illnesses that relate directly to it. And the second question is the nature of justice. Nobody has stood trial in a court of law for that industrial disaster, and people feel that justice has been denied.
Well, we're going to tackle those two questions with the BBC's Alan Little about 40 minutes from now, Bhopal 25 years after. But for you, we're talking about the job summit at the White House. What would you do to change for a new job?
My name is Lawrence Perry. I'm a U.S. Army recruiter in New Jersey, and I just find it ridiculous that people are not willing to move at all for a job. I talk to people every day in my job that are complaining about unemployment in New Jersey, but they aren't willing to leave it to fix the problem.
Relocation, relocation, relocation. Tell us your take on the economic situation at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Pakistan is a location that will have a strong effect on Afghanistan, but can they fix Afghanistan when they have their own problems?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. So I didn't actually count the number of references in President Obama's speech at West Point this week. References to Pakistan. All right.
Right.
There were a lot of them. Here's one.
We're in Afghanistan to prevent a cancer from once again spreading through that country. But this same cancer has also taken root in the border region of Pakistan. That's why we need a strategy that works on both sides of the border.
Certainly, if President Obama had not mentioned Pakistan at all in his speech, it would have been extraordinarily controversial.
Absolutely.
Of course, he mentioned the 30,000 new troops going into the fight as early next year and a withdrawal that will begin possibly in the summer of 2011. But let's talk about that both sides of the border issue. The Pakistan question and talking about it in context of Afghanistan wasn't controversial last night. But here's a very controversial statement that the president made more than a year ago during the presidential campaign.
If we have Osama bin Laden in our sights, and the Pakistani government is unable or unwilling to take them out, then I think that we have to act, and we will take them out. We will kill bin Laden. We will crush al-Qaeda. That has to be our biggest national security priority.
So does President Obama's biggest national security priority mean sort of ignoring the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan and considering them a piece of the same battlefield? Joining us now to react to this and other news this morning, really out of Pakistan, the Pakistani prime minister speaking in London, saying that Osama bin Laden actually isn't in Pakistan at all, is Ahmed Rashid, journalist and author of Descent into Chaos, The United States and the Failure of Nation Building in Pakistan, Afghanistan and Central Asia. He joins us from Lahore, Pakistan. Ahmed Rashid, good morning.
Good morning.
And Adil Najam, professor of international relations at Boston University. He's on the line from New England. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
What do you make of this statement from the Pakistani leader that, in fact, Osama bin Laden isn't in Pakistan at all?
He's probably telling the truth if he's saying he doesn't know where Osama bin Laden is. I don't think he does. I don't think anyone else does. And if they did, they should really tell someone who can do something about it. If he did know where he was, I'm sure he would have acted. And if the U.S. knew where he was, I'm quite sure the U.S. would be sending some of the drones they're already sending after Osama bin Laden. Now, could he be in Pakistan? Yes. But let's be very clear that this notion that somehow the Prime Minister of Pakistan has the address and the exact place where Osama bin Laden is really quite nonsense.
Well, let's talk about the border then. If we can stipulate for the moment that the apprehension of Osama bin Laden would be a huge story, maybe the security priority in Pakistan has nothing to do with al-Qaeda anymore. How much do you think the U.S. and the Pentagon and this surge is about violating and going after targets inside Pakistan, not simply in Afghanistan?
Two things. One, I think security in Pakistan now has a lot to do with al-Qaeda, certainly has a lot to do with the Taliban. Whether Osama bin Laden is in Pakistan or not, it doesn't matter. It's really not Osama bin Laden. It's the people who are doing these suicide bombings in Pakistan nearly on a daily basis. And therefore, what happens to the Taliban and to al-Qaeda in Afghanistan will have an impact on Pakistan. It's not Osama bin Laden is the least of the issues here. The
right.
issues is the larger one. Pakistan is very concerned about this for at least two very real reasons. One is that as the U.S. military squeezes, and if the U.S. military squeezes the Taliban in Afghanistan, where do you think they will go? There's a flubber effect. You squeeze them one place, they're going to go across that border to Pakistan. So success of the U.S. military operation in Afghanistan is really going to mean more Talibanization in Pakistan.
All right.
More violence in Pakistan.
Adil Najam is professor of international relations at Boston University. Thanks so much. Ahmed Rashid joins us now from Lahore, Pakistan. He's the author of Descent into Chaos, The United States and the Failure of Nation Building in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia. Ahmed Rashid, How sacrosanct do you think the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan is to the U.S. Pentagon?
Well, the border has been breached by the U.S. for some time because they've been using drone missile attacks some 50 miles inside Pakistan to take out the leadership elements of the Afghan Taliban, Al-Qaeda, the Pakistani Taliban, wherever they can find them. But at the same time, I think there's no question that the U.S. is not going to be wanting to cross that border on foot. In other words, put American troops on the ground on Pakistani soil with or without permission of the Pakistani authorities in order to deal with this threat. So what I do envisage is probably an extension of the drone attacks. They could continue in not just the tribal areas bordering Afghanistan, but also deeper into Pakistan and other areas where the Afghan Taliban are known to be. But what it really needs is the full cooperation of the Pakistani military.
Well, let's talk about that. Can the Obama administration count on cooperation of the Pakistani military in fighting the Taliban and, more importantly, in keeping Pakistan together?
Well, there's no doubt that the Pakistani military are fighting now very aggressively against the Pakistani Taliban in the tribal areas. But they're certainly not going up against the Afghan Taliban. We know roughly where they are. They are very secure. They have not been attacked or harassed in any way. The question is, can Pakistan afford to go up against the Afghan Taliban when it's fighting this other battle? Now, I mean, I have been suggesting that there are several things that Pakistan could do without opening necessarily another battlefront. They could apprehend these Afghan Taliban because they know where they are. They could put them under some kind of house arrest. They could stop the flow of logistics and manpower that crosses the border from Pakistan into Afghanistan. So there are several intermediary steps that the Pakistanis could take, which would restrict the ability of the Afghan Taliban in Afghanistan.
But will they? Let's look ahead to the future. President Obama suggested that a withdrawal will begin in 2011. Of course, we've got the 2012 presidential election. Let's just fast forward to 2013. What's Pakistan going to look like in 2013, Ahmed Rashid, and how does that affect the strategy?
Well, you know, that's very difficult to say. This is the most unpredictable country in the world right now, and there are several crises here which are all coming to a head. The Taliban, the fight against extremism, the bombings, but also a very dire economic situation and a very tense political situation.
In a nation of variables and all of them floating on this lake of instability, Ahmed Rashid, thanks so much for the insight. Certainly we'll check in with you before 2013. Ahmed Rashid, of course, journalist and author of Descent into Chaos, on the phone from Lahore, Pakistan, talking about the implications for Pakistan in President Obama's new Afghanistan strategy. Now, at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in on some of the headlines we're watching.
We've just been talking about Pakistan and how central that country is to the new U.S. strategy in the region unveiled by President Obama. This morning, our partner, the BBC, has spoken to the president's special envoy for Afghanistan and Pakistan, Richard Holbrooke. He said he was confident the additional 30,000 troops will bring a turning point in the war. He also said working closely with Pakistan is one of the keys to the new strategy.
And when the United States drove the Taliban and Al-Qaeda into Pakistan without any coordination with the Pakistanis, that was a great tragedy. It is one of the underlying causes of the situation we now confront.
Richard Holbrooke speaking to the BBC. Meanwhile, President Obama's top officials in Washington have been trying to persuade Congress that the plan can work. They've been saying the 18-month timeline for the start of U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan is flexible. Back at home, we've had the latest figures on unemployment claims. Fewer people claimed unemployment benefits last week, down to 457,000 for the fifth straight week. That's a drop, and it was unexpected.
What would we do without Vice President Joe Biden? He told the NBC Today show this morning that he had no idea those party gatecrashers at the Indian state dinner shouldn't have been at the dinner.
And I thought, well, these guys are just staples in the, you know, in Washington society. I was surprised when I turned on the television to find out they were apparently gatecrashers.
Future guests to the White House will now be checked off a list, and White House staff will be stationed at checkpoints alongside the Secret Service. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, cars, cars, cars at the L.A. Auto Show. Paul Eisenstein will be there, and more on the leadership change at General Motors. That and a few takeouts in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
We have some takeouts on stories we're following this week, and we have our cast of characters with us to talk about them. We've got Paul Eisenstein, the publisher of the Detroit Bureau. He's in Los Angeles at the L.A. Car Show. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Celeste.
Also, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen and a Louis story. Good morning to you guys.
Morning.
So, Paul, out there in L.A., we were Detroit's probably still reeling from the news that Fritz Henderson is no longer the CEO of GM. So you're at the auto show, and you actually heard from, instead of Fritz Henderson, you heard from Bob Lutz, their vice chairman. What did he have to say?
Bob Lutz substituted because Fritz was supposed to be the keynote speaker at this year's auto show. Bob wanted to talk about cars, but he didn't have many opportunities to get away from the subject of the shakeup at General Motors. And he was surprisingly blunt, saying that he was surprised by what happened. He apparently didn't have a clue, and that he, like a lot of other people, is not very happy about the shakeup there. He seems to be very upset about it.
Well, Bob Lutz is generally a pretty straight shooter, but he also usually would rather talk about cars than just about anything. So let's talk about those cars. From what I understand, the L.A. Auto Show doesn't have all the bells and whistles that other auto shows have had in the past, but what it has is lots and lots of small vehicles.
Oh, you've got a few cars out there, like the Audi e-tron, which you're talking about all sorts of power, you know, something like 400 horsepower, but it's an electric car, so that's an interesting thing. And a lot of electric cars here, a lot of talk about this so-called electrification, and a lot of small cars. This is what's real interesting at this show. You're really seeing the future is downsizing. So we saw the launch of the Ford Fiesta, which is the American version of
the
very popular European vehicle.
Yeah.
Which you know is a subcompact, and they're hoping to make a real dent in the market with it. We're also seeing Uplight, which is a prototype of a vehicle that VW may bring in. All sorts of small cars, Mazda 2. We're really seeing that the future of this auto industry is moving away from light trucks into crossovers and very, very small cars.
Okay, that's Paul Eisenstein talking to us from the LA Auto Show. He's the publisher of the DetroitBureau.com.
When's he going to drive an Audi e-tron? That's what I want to know. So, Louise Story, finance reporter for our partners in the New York Times, if I lent somebody $45 billion and they paid me back early, I would be really happy.
You would be happy. And in fact, the government is declaring, the Treasury Department is declaring that Bank of America repaying the $45 billion in bailout money is a victory, is a success. A spokesman for the Treasury Department last night told me that this shows that the government is pulling out of the private sector and they're declaring victory here, as is Bank of America.
All right, but what's really going on behind the scenes, particularly on the B of A side?
So Bank of America has been hunting for a new CEO. You know, their old CEO, Ken Lewis, retired early, very much under fire. They've been having trouble getting a new CEO. Think about it. If you're some bank executive out there, do you want to come run a company that's under the thumb of the government? No, you don't.
Well, I'll do it.
You'll do it?
Public radio, you know, we're under the thumb.
If they'll pay you
everybody.
A few million dollars.
Sure, I'll be happy to do it.
But, you know, bank executives are very wary. So this frees Bank of America up to find the new CEO. But it comes at a real cost, Bank of America.
Let's just say the reason it frees them up is because the pay requirements won't be under the federal oversight, and they can pay the anybody, which is presumably anything, which is presumably
right. Bank of America will not have to report in about
all of its bonus
payments. But, you know, there were really two sides to this. So Bank of America wanted out. It wanted out from the government. But the government also, and the Treasury Department in particular, they're facing pressure about this bailout. You know, Tim Geithner, the Secretary of the Treasury, was on the Hill yesterday.
And he's going to be there today, too.
Yep. I mean, he's there a lot. And yesterday he said, look, we're close to ending this bailout. You know, people in Washington are talking about maybe using some of the bailout money to help create jobs. That's the topic of today with the jobs forum.
Mm-hmm.
So in general, we're seeing a shift to try to get this money out of the banks and put it to help Main Street, which has been, of course, the criticism of the government is, let's help Main Street.
Yes or no? Does this mean Bank of America is healthy?
They are healthier.
Healthier.
They are going to have to raise a lot of money from private investors. But, you know, we've got a rough economy ahead.
Healthier. That wasn't a yes or no answer.
I'll take healthier.
Sorry.
Now we're going to go to sports. And, you know, Ibrahim, you could kind of say that this weekend is a job interview for some of these college football players, right? We have two of the best college teams out there are going to be playing each other on Saturday in the SEC Conference Championship. We've got the Florida Gators, and they're playing the Alabama's Crimson Tide. What are you expecting out of this game?
This is the biggest game of the year. This might as well be the championship game, the national championship game.
Florida has Tim Tebow, who is probably one of the most record-breaking quarterbacks in the history of college football.
Heisman candidate.
But they also have a linebacker named Brandon Spikes. Now, with any of these teams in the top level, if you're looking at what they're made of and what they're comprised of, what the DNA of a championship team is, you have to have a defensive star and an offensive star. Alabama also has a top-flight coach. So
right.
Florida has Urban Meyer, who's won national championships before. Alabama has Nick Saban, who's won a national championship before. But they also have Mark Ingram, who's the son of the former wide receiver for the Giants, of the same name, Mark Ingram. He is another Heisman candidate at running back. And then they also have a linebacker, Rolando McClain, who is the silent type. He'll come at you and he'll pop you in the face and make you hurt and not say anything about it. These two teams are evenly matched. It's going to be scary in Atlanta this weekend to see who comes out on top.
So do you have a prediction then?
I'm going with Florida because they got the juice, but we'll see, man. This is what it's all about. The winner gets to play Texas in the national championship game.
Wait, what about BCS? What about Boise State? Do they have any chance of anything?
You might as well take the C out of BCS because it's not really a championship game after this. It'll just be the bowl series after this.
Hey, now, quickly, because we have a team that is the first team to start 0-18, and it's not the Detroit Lions.
It's not. It's the New Jersey Nets, and they are now the worst starting team
in the NBA.
History. So it's sad for Nets fans, and hopefully
they're the best at something.
But they're actually not that bad. They have a lot of players that they're top players that are injured. So there's hope for the Nets.
Nice. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor. Coming up, author Barbara Ehrenreich joins us with a conversation about women's health. That's in a few minutes. And later this hour, we will go back to Bhopal, India, 25 years ago, the site of one of the worst environmental and industrial disasters that affected millions of people.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, is the battle over mammograms a sign that the feminist movement is faltering? Author Barbara Ehrenreich thinks so, and she's going to explain in just a few moments. But first, here are some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. New jobless numbers out in the past hour. The number of Americans who filed new unemployment claims fell for the fifth straight week. It's still a big number, though, at 457,000. And as we've been talking about this morning, President Obama has invited 130 business leaders to the White House to get feedback on how to tackle the unemployment problem. Earlier on the show, we spoke to Newsweek columnist and friend of The Takeaway, Dan Gross. He's optimistic. Mystic will have job growth sooner rather than later. The key, he says, is to look at productivity, which is growing at between 8 and 9%.
Which means that basically employers are asking employees to kind of run ever, ever faster on the treadmill. And at a certain point, they have to break down and hire new people.
But with the jobless rate at a 23-year high, the president today will sound out ideas like targeted tax credits and increased access to financing for small businesses.
Bank of America will be the first big bank to completely pay off its federal bailout. The nation's largest lender says it's ready to give back the $45 billion in aid it received from the Treasury last year. General Electric is no longer running a media business. It announced this morning it's selling its controlling stake in NBC Universal to Comcast for almost $14 billion in cash and assets. Comcast CEO Brian Roberts told the Today Show that NBC's cable channels are a big part of the deal, but he's not forgetting the importance of the Peacock network.
Broadcast television is an important part of the fabric of America, and we're very committed to trying to see ways to make it successful.
Yeah, there should be a laugh track behind that soundbite. The deal makes Comcast one of the world's largest media companies. So the markets are open and reacting to all of this. Dow is up about 20 points in the early going, and the S&P is up about 3 points. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
It sparked perhaps a surprising controversy. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force issued a recommendation saying women should hold off on getting screened for breast cancer until the age of 50. The previous recommendation had been to start at 40. And in some ways, this has become a proxy fight for the larger issue of who controls who and what will be covered by health care reform. Barbara Ehrenreich is the author of Bright Sighted, How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America, and she wrote an op-ed for the LA Times saying feminism has been replaced by the pink ribbon breast cancer cult. Barbara, good morning.
Good to be with you, Celeste.
You too. Tell me what the pink ribbon breast cancer cult is.
Oh, well, you see, especially in October, you saw it all around you, right? I mean, we see so many products that come with a pink ribbon and some promise to donate a tiny percentage of the profits to breast cancer research. Then October is the month also of all the walks and runs for the cure. You know, there's a it's a major cultural phenomenon, which is there's no equivalent of for any other disease.
I have to ask you. You were talking, and you yourself are a survivor of breast cancer, and you spoke in your op-ed about that this issue isn't about healthcare costs. Why is it not about healthcare costs?
Well, we're very sensitized to the issue of healthcare costs right now, with health reform having been debated for months. And I think that, you know, there was an immediate suspicion is, oh, they're going to take something away. Look, they're going to the new guidelines are just to reduce the amount of care we
rationing.
Can get. However, I was really alarmed when a few weeks before that, an amendment to the health reform bill in the House of Representatives would have taken away women's abortion rights, even if they had private insurance to pay for abortion.
But not much discussion of that, I guess.
Right.
You know, what was so profound about your article to me is that, you know, the larger issues of feminism are being concealed behind this narrower medical issue. And we've seen that with people with disabilities, where it's great to talk about a cure, but not good to talk about economic equity for those kinds of people. Is this sort of a precedent in American culture?
Well, I think it is. I think it's also, I should say, there's no equivalent really in any other nation. We uniquely do this. We have this pink ribbon culture. It's very visible here. We also have higher rates of mammography screening than other countries, and higher rates of chemotherapy than other countries for breast cancer, without any improvement in mortality relative to those other countries. So there's something funny going on here. It's a little hard to penetrate. And I can sympathize with the urge to say, oh, well, you can't take anything away from us. You know, and I would certainly say if these screenings worked, well, damn the expense, just do it, right?
Right.
It's a terrible disease. But, you know, the evidence it's been leaking in for a long time. In other countries, you know, the doctors from other countries come here and they say, what? What? You're doing all these mammograms? You're doing all this treatment? And there's finally been a realization, and we're not getting anywhere with that, that in fact we're subjecting an awful lot of women, and I think I would count myself as one of them, into possibly unnecessary and rather ghastly and debilitating treatments.
So if what I'm hearing from you and from your op-ed is correct, there are some really what you think very serious issues, feminist issues out there that are being brushed aside. And you mentioned the abortion debate over the Bart Stupak amendment to the health care bill. That's being brushed aside and shoved under the table while people really focus on the breast care mammogram testing issue, which to your mind is just not that important of an issue.
Well, I think it is important. But what it's important to do is to realize we have not been achieving a lot in this nation by doing so much mammography and perhaps over-treatment for breast cancer. It has not been, you know, it's not been saving the lives it's supposed to be. That is very important to recognize and deal with that fact. And to realize also that the pink ribbon breast cancer cult means it's a very corporate-involved kind of thing. What does a corporation do when it wants to signal to its consumers that it's woman-friendly? It stamps a pink ribbon on its product. You know, it's like apple pie. You couldn't find the same level of concern ever for AIDS because that's a little bit edgy, right? A little touchy, that disease. But breast cancer is all apple pie. Every corporation wants in on it, wants to sponsor the runs and the blocks and so forth, and that we've kind of fallen into something here that may not even be healthy.
Are you not an argument, a support? Are you not yourself a support for the argument that this is not about the cost or the numbers or how effective these are, that you yourself, your life may have been saved by a mammography?
It may have been, but I also hold open the several other nastier possibilities. One is that mammography itself contributes to breast cancer. I mean, that's not a point. I mean, that really happens. And that in my case, it might have been, you know, how do I know it wasn't the cumulative exposure to radiation from all that mammography beginning when I was 40 that caused the, well, I think I began a little later than that, but that caused the tumor eventually to occur. Or, even more likely in my case, I was taking hormone replacement therapy because it had been advertised as sort of this wonderful way of preventing almost all the diseases of old age. And so I've been taking that. And about a year after my cancer diagnosis, it was found out that hormone replacement therapy actually contributes to breast cancer and does not do anything for the other things it was supposed to do.
It sounds to me like the takeaway from Barbara Ehrenreich is really a message to the feminists of the United States that they shouldn't get distracted by political correctness and focus on the issues that really affect women's rights and women's health on a daily basis. Barbara Ehrenreich is the author of Bright Sided, How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America. She joined us from Virginia.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. The NFL has been used to hearing this sound for a very long time.
Kickoff is fielded at the 3-yard line by Chris Henry.
Oh, what a shot! The 22-yard line, a monster hit by Darrell Reed.
But there's also been some high-profile head injuries in football from shots like the one you just heard. Players like Ben Roethlisberger of the Pittsburgh Steelers and Arizona Cardinals' Kurt Warner. And now the NFL is announcing new rules when it comes to concussions. The rules state that any player who exhibits significant signs of concussion will be removed from the game or practice and will be barred from returning that same day. But is this really going to help solve the problem? Gary Belsky's editor-in-chief of ESPN, The Magazine, and he's going to join us now and help answer this question. Gary, what do you think about these new rules? Is this getting to the heart of the problem?
I think it is getting to the heart of the problem, and I think the solution is a long-term incremental change in the way that NFL players, by the way, also high school and college players, think about concussions, meaning there's always been an understanding by football players that they could end up being hobbled in their 40s and 50s because of bad knees and arthritis and things like that. They were willing to make that bargain. They're smart. They knew that there was money involved, and they could understand that. But only now are they starting to understand that there's also a chance they won't be able to remember what their kids' names are when they're 40 and 50 or who they are. And that's a bargain that players are not even willing to make, I think, even in their 20s and 30s when it's hard for people to sort of be able to project forward. So, yes, I think in the short term it's going to probably help people because some people are going to be withheld from games, and that's good. And in the long run, it's going to make the code of NFL toughness a little less rigid when it comes to concussions and getting dinged up or having your bell rung, all these phrases that have always been, you know, playful when in fact this is serious business.
We had a Freakonomics author, Stephen Dubner, here talking about this issue a short time ago, and I want you to listen to what he said.
You're going to see the union say, hey, we know they're doing it we know they play because they want to play. We know they're often well paid, but let's not forget they're human beings and they shouldn't be getting their brains bashed out if they don't need to be.
So, Gary Belsky, what role did the unions have in bringing about this change in policy from the NFL?
Well, it's hard to know, right? Traditionally, before, when Gene Upshaw was the union boss, and there's a new one now because he died about a year ago, when traditionally the union and the NFL have been very much in lockstep in terms of, over the past 20 or 25 years, in terms of their approaches. I think the union probably had some effect on this, but quite frankly, I think there's been a significant amount of publicity over the last 3 or 4 years, a gathering storm.
No, and you've been a part of that. You've been a part of that. You, the Gumbel Show, have been all over this story.
Yeah, we started a lot of the concussion stuff about 2 or 3 years ago with a series of stories. But I also think Roger Goodell, who's the new commissioner, he's not so new anymore, he's been a commissioner for about 3 years, I think he doesn't inherit any of the legacy of the previous policies, and he's a guy who clearly is concerned about the league's image and also about the league's players, because I think he views them as partners. And so fundamentally I think it's about a new union boss, a relatively new commissioner, and a huge amount of publicity. This is a case where the media actually did a good job beating on a drum.
What stars does this affect today playing the game, do you think?
Oh, I think it's going to affect, you know, the skill players, the running backs, the defensive linemen, the quarterbacks, wide receivers. I think everybody's going to benefit from this, though, to be quite honest.
Okay, Gary Belsky is the editor-in-chief of ESPN, The Magazine. He's talking about new rules from the NFL. They state any player who shows signs of concussion will be removed from the game. They'll also be barred from returning to play the same day.
And Gary's taking some rightful credit there for this change in policy.
He should take some credit. He and ESPN have done a great job on this issue.
John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headley. Coming up, Bhopal, India, 25 years later. How are residents dealing with the effects of one of the worst industrial disasters in history? More in just a few moments. We're also talking with you about jobs. The president hosting that job summit at the White House. How much would you change for a new job? How much retooling do you think the economy needs? Would you learn new skills? What wouldn't you do? Tell us your story and what is and isn't a deal breaker when it comes to taking a new job. You can reach us at 8778-MYTAKE. Email, of course, at mytake@thetakeaway.org. So let's look at leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. Pakistani Prime Minister Yousuf Jilani has been giving a news conference in London this morning, saying he does not think Osama bin Laden is hiding out in Pakistan. Meanwhile, President Obama's special envoy to the region, Richard Holbrooke, has been speaking to our partner, the BBC, about the new White House strategy announced this week. Holbrooke says the key is to ensure that Afghan security forces can defend the state against the Taliban.
The fact is that the people of Afghanistan do not want a permanent foreign presence in their country. We will continue training the police and the army. If they cannot defend themselves, we will have a very difficult situation on our hands.
Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke goes in front of the Senate Banking Committee today. He's hoping to be confirmed for another 4 years. Looking ahead, back at home, President Barack Obama is hosting a jobs summit today. He's going to speak at 1:30 Eastern. The official national unemployment rate is at 10.2%, but we did get job numbers today saying that that's dropped. The new claims have dropped for the fifth straight week. And we have Politico's Ayman Javers here to cover the summit and let us know what's going on there. So first of all, Ayman, who among the CIOs, who are the big hitters that are going to be there today?
Well, you're going to see a lot of big names at the White House today, including Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, Randall Stephenson, the head of AT&T, Fred Smith of FedEx, and on and on. You've got Disney, Boeing, Siemens, Dow Corning, a lot of big executives at the White House today. But there's some question about what exactly they're going to be doing and whether or not they can come up with any new ideas that haven't been thought of already in this recession.
And to what extent can the government actually influence whether companies begin to hire again? Are people expecting concrete results from this summit?
No, I don't think so. I mean, this is pretty much a messaging exercise by the White House in which they're going to go out there and show that they are thinking of every possible idea. They're doing every single thing they can do. They're talking to the best and brightest to try to reverse that 10.2 number that you talked about. And, of course, tomorrow we're going to get new monthly job numbers, and the expectation is that we'll see even further job losses having occurred in the month of November. So the idea here is to host this summit today, have some headlines in the newspapers about it tomorrow when Americans wake up to what could be another fairly grim job number.
Okay, Politico's Ayman Javers. He's covering the summit for us today.
The people of Bhopal are still fleeing the town. I'm now standing at the platform of the city's railway station, and there are at least 10,000 people here, absolutely packed, trying to get out of the city.
Trip back in time now. That's the sound 25 years ago of the BBC's live coverage of the people of Bhopal, India, trying to escape the economic or the environmental disaster, industrial disaster that killed 8,000 people right off the bat. 40 tons of poisonous gases, which escaped from the Union Carbide factory in that city, caused an industrial disaster that the people of Bhopal are still reeling from today. To take a look at the long-term effects of that accident, we spoke with BBC special correspondent Alan Little, who just returned from Bhopal, where he'd been speaking with people about their memories, their ongoing battles for justice, and their medical problems that, as we mentioned, persist to this day. We asked Alan Little if the city's residents still feel that impact.
Well, you know, when you walk through those slum neighborhoods that are so densely populated, every household there has a story to tell about that night, and it's as vivid as it was, as it would have been had the disaster occurred a week ago. I'll give you one example. I worked with a young man, a journalist, who's 25 years old. He was 5 months old at the time of the disaster. He doesn't remember anything about it, obviously. His 11-year-old sister picked him up and ran and got separated from her family. There were eight brothers and sisters in that family, and when they reassembled, there were only three of them left. Mother, father, and five of the siblings were all killed. An 11-year-old girl and a 13-year-old brother survived. The 13-year-old brother developed psychiatric problems later in life directly related to the experience of that night and losing five of his siblings and both his parents, and committed committed suicide 3 years ago at the age of 35 after spending years as a full-time campaigner for justice. So those are the kind of problems that persist.
And, you know, you talk to people who really explained how vast the problems that persist still are for the community of Bhopal. Here's Satyu Sarangi, who runs a charity called Samhavni, which is a charity which campaigns specifically for Bhopal victims. Listen.
So what we have is a medical disaster, a human disaster, far larger today than 25 years back.
All right, so Alan, set the stage here. 40 tons of a chemical from a factory that's now closed, 25 years on, it's a larger medical problem today. How does that work?
Well, there are two things. First of all, those who were directly exposed to the gas on the night, there were tens of thousands of people who had long-term chronic problems. They're aging now. And as they age, their condition is getting worse, not better, because it's being added to other kinds of conditions. I went into a hospital there, and there was a 53-year-old man who looked about 75. So he's been living with us pretty much all his adult life. He was 28 on the night of the gas. He hasn't been able to work since. He's been in and out of hospital for the last 25 years. He got about $1,000 in compensation, and he said to me, "You know what? The ones who died are gone. But there are tens of thousands of us who think of ourselves as the living dead." That's the first category. The second category is children born since the disaster whose parents were either exposed to the gas or who spent years drinking contaminated groundwater. There's an unusually high incidence of birth defects in children, even children born as recently as 5 or 6 years ago. And there's a strikingly high incidence of growth retardation. I met a 22-year-old man who had the body, the voice, the frame and the demeanour of a 10-year-old boy. He hasn't developed into adulthood. And there is some evidence that one of the byproducts of MIC, the gas that leaked, can impede in some boy children the production of testosterone, right, which is essential for adult development.
And indeed, the people of Bhopal unwittingly are in this experiment as to the effects of methyl isocyanate on large populations. I mean, it's been a quarter century, and you talk about the medical problems. Union Carbide, of course, a company that ceased to exist, became a subsidiary of Dow Chemical Corporation. And here is the sentiment that you found everywhere you went in Bhopal, and from a resident by the name of Hazira B.
It's been 25 years and we've still not got justice. Old people, young people, even children.
Alan Little, what constitutes justice in this particular case?
Nobody stood trial in a court of law. The American global chairman of Union Carbide flew into Bhopal just a few days afterwards and was immediately arrested, Mr. Warren Anderson. But he was granted bail and allowed to fly home to the United States. There are still outstanding criminal charges against both Mr. Anderson and Union Carbide, which, as you say, no longer exists. But those charges are not going anywhere. They're chugging through India's complicated legal system. There's no case against Union Carbide or the company chairman in the United States. And Union Carbide settled out of court with the Indian government, and the terms of that agreement represent a full and final settlement of Union Carbide's criminal and civil liability.
Well, all over the internet, the ghostly images of people who died at Bhopal are still there. The popular culture references to Bhopal are in songs in South Asia, numerous uncountable songs in South Asia. But still today in the 21st century, you have millions of people living close to huge industrial facilities all over the world. Lessons learned, or has Bhopal forgotten?
Bhopal, it's become a watchword for what big companies from the rich world can sometimes get away with when they do business among the poor. At least that is how it's seen in India and in much of the developing world. So the Bhopal is certainly not forgotten in the developing world.
And worth remembering, Alan Little, BBC special correspondent, just recently returned from Bhopal, India, the scene of the worst industrial accident of our time. He joined us earlier this morning from London. So for those of you who remember that disaster, maybe you were experiencing it at home or even visited the area sometime during the past 25 years, tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Did you work at Union Carbide at the time? We'd love to hear all the stories.
And we also want to hear your stories about job seeking. Are there deal breakers for you? Are there things that you would not do in order to get a job? Let us know. Would you move across the country? Sarah emails us, my fiance and I are fresh graduates, yet very underemployed in northeastern Ohio. We started to plan a relocation, but I just read an article about a tax credit for graduates remaining in Ohio that may go through our state senate to prevent brain drain. We will surely be talking about this over dinner tonight when he gets home.
We have to do a segment about relocating workers.
Absolutely.
It's a great
I could lead that because I recently relocated for a job. Another person emails us, here's a reason why I wouldn't move for a new job. My spouse has a good job. I have school-aged kids, one who's struggling and would suffer major setbacks if we moved, and it's very expensive to move a family.
That is true.
Let us know your take at 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. John, I'll see you Monday.
I'll see you Tuesday. You'll see me Tuesday, yes.
Yeah, welcome. Congratulations
with
the birth of the new baby tomorrow.
New baby comes tomorrow. Good luck, everyone. Thanks so much.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.